said on Thursday and ask him about the bang on the head, which was totally and utterly amazing. Right, gang, let's get this show underway. It's Radio City 96.7. It's City Talk 105.9. And this is Sunday night, 4 hours. Hey, although Tony Benn retired as an MP some years ago, he remains a giant in British politics. As I wrote in The Echo on Thursday night, I don't always agree with what he's got to say, but my God, you've got to admire the man. He's 83, he's still not satisfied with the world, and he's out there at public meetings still banging the drum for his socialist principles of welfare, not warfare. He's one of those rare entities, a politician who genuinely believes in something more than his own skin. If there were more like him, I bet more people would go back to voting. Tony will be in Liverpool tomorrow. And remember, he's on at 6.30, 6.30, not the time advertised. So he's on at 6.30. So Tony will be in Liverpool tomorrow speaking at the Stop the War Coalition public meeting. But he's joining me right now on the line from his home. See, told you. He's just a dedicated man. Hello, Tony.
Hello. I look forward to this. You know, Liverpool is my favourite city.
Well, I've got to say, when we went to the Sony Awards, and we won quite a few this year at the station, You were the one person who was presenting award and decided to make a speech in front of all those broadcasters. You weren't going to waste the time.
Well, I'm an old broadcaster myself. My first job was the BBC, and I was paid £9 a week. It was like local radio. It was a North American service. You know, I did interviews, went to Wimbledon, chaired meetings. It was great fun, and my interest in broadcasting began ever since, from that moment.
Tony, why is Stop the War still having meetings? After all, even though the Americans have agreed to withdraw their troops from Iraq, is it 2012, isn't it?
Well, I mean, if you look back at it, the war's been going on from 2003. That's longer than the First World War. The Americans are spending $400 million a day while people are starving in Haiti, Ethiopia and Somalia. We've got our troops there. And although they say they're getting out, you wait and see. When they do finally negotiate something, you can be sure the Americans will keep bases there because they went in for the oil. And that's what took us in with them. Greatest mistake Blair ever made. Then we've got a war in Afghanistan. And, a million Iraqis have been killed, and I think it's 2 million are refugees in Afghanistan. You know, they're having to send in more troops because you can't win that battle. I mean, the Russians were booted out of Afghanistan. Britain invaded Afghanistan in 1839, captured Kabul, and was thrown out the following year, and 15,000 troops were killed. British troops were killed. So I think it's a hopeless war, and now Bush warns Iran, you might attack them, and there's the trouble in the Caucasus. I think all sensible people now are looking for a way to solve the world's problems without killing people. And I've got 10 grandchildren, and my interest in politics is what sort of a world will they live in?
Tony, is the war about oil?
What?
Is the war about oil in Iraq?
Yes, of course it is. Of course it's about oil. Indeed, that was admitted by the first member of Bush's cabinet. He said, when we met, when Bush was first elected, 8 years ago, the first thing on the agenda was getting rid of Saddam in order to get the oil. And, I mean, he said it himself. And there's no doubt that's what it's about. I mean, oil is the... Look, there's oil in the Caucasus. That's why there's been trouble there. There was oil around the Falklands. That's what that was about. The Kuwait wars are oil. I mean, oil is the thing that superpowers want to hang on to, and so does everybody else.
Would you agree with those that say that we're entering a new Cold War era with Russia, now that they're flexing their military might again? The Americans who have based, well, their bases all over the countries, are former Eastern Bloc. I mean, would you say we're entering a Cold War?
Well, that's what they're whipping up. Nigel, it's a very complicated situation because, you see, the old Soviet Union was a big sort of empire, and Georgia broke away from it after the end of the Soviet Union. But a lot of Russians lived in Georgia, the people of what they call South Ossetia, and the Russians stayed there as peacekeepers. And then a few weeks ago, the Georgian government decided to attack the Russian province of South Ossetia, and the Russians responded and so on. But, you see, really, the argument is about NATO. The North American Treaty Organization is being pushed by the Americans because they want to encircle Russia, and that's the cause of the trouble. Don't misunderstand me, I've no time for the Russians or anybody else, but I think to have a sort of new Cold War or a real war with Russia would be a catastrophe, and listening to some of the American and British ministers, you'd think that's what it's all about.
Should we not fear the Chinese, though?
Am I what?
Should we not fear the Chinese more than the Russians?
Well, I mean, the truth is that we live in a world of empires, and if you look back on history, I mean, take the British Empire as the simplest example. When I was born, 20% of the population of the world was governed from London. We governed India, we governed Pakistan, we governed chunks of Africa. And why did we go there in the first place? Because we were the first industrial nation. We had a big navy, we had industry, and we simply conquered the world, or huge chunks of the world, because we got cheap raw materials, and then with our military force, we forced them to buy the goods we produced. That's what empires are about. And you see, I remember coming back in a troop ship in 1945. I was an RAF pilot, and I heard the words of the UN Charter. And they're written in my heart. It said, "We, the peoples of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has caused untold suffering to mankind." And that was the pledge the old boys like me gave to the younger generation. And when we went into Afghanistan, Iraq, we tore up the charter. And now the Cold War is being brought back because it's the battle for resources all over again.
I'm talking to Tony Benn, who's speaking in Liverpool at 6:30 on Monday evening at the Sylvestrian Club, Sylvester Street in Vauxhall. Now, you fought in World War II. You lived through Korea, Vietnam, the Cuban Missile Crisis,
yep,
the first and now the second Gulf War, the fall of the Berlin Wall, and it goes on, doesn't it? Everything. What can we do to get world peace?
Well, I mean, the first thing to remember is this, and I think of my grandchildren, I mentioned, they're the first generation in human history that have the technical capacity to destroy the human race. I mean, you kill one or two people with a bow and arrow or a spear or a gun or a bomb, but with chemical, nuclear and biological weapons, the human race could obliterate itself. That's the first generation in history, but also, and this is what gives me hope, it's the first generation in human history that has the know-how, the technology, the money to solve the problems of the human race. And that's the big choice we have to make. And it's very important we get beyond the old struggle of empires, Chinese empire, there'll be an Indian empire, Brazil's growing, and we've just got to find a way of sorting out our differences. And what Europe wants is not a new Cold War. What Europe wants, instead of NATO, we want to have a European security arrangement bringing Russia in and everybody else. And then everybody would feel secure. I think NATO is a bit like the sort of French Foreign Legion. We go wherever the Americans tell us. I mean, what the hell has a North Atlantic Treaty Organization got to do with Afghanistan? I didn't think the North Atlantic ran through Afghanistan. But we're kidded along. It's always find a new enemy, frighten us, and then persuade us to waste money on war when we need it for pensioners and health and all the rest of it. I mean, it is crazy, and I think most people see this, you know.
After what you've been through, how can you stay so optimistic?
Well, I'm an old man. I mean, I'm 83. I'll be 84 in April, and I don't want anything anymore. I've seen a lot in my life. I mean, I've had a wonderful life. I've seen a lot, and I don't want anything. For example, in Liverpool tomorrow night, nobody there is going to be asked to vote for me. So they can relax, and so can I. And I can simply say what I think and listen to them. And actually, the value of most of these meetings is I learn so much, because in my opinion, the public have got a far higher level of intelligence than the politicians or the media proprietors recognise. I mean, everyone I talk to has got something really interesting to say, so I love listening.
Now, I know you met Mahatma Gandhi
when
you were a child. Was he one of the people that maybe inspired you with your messages of peace and resistance?
Well, it's interesting you say this, because I was six and he was in London. My dad was Secretary of State for India at the Labour government at the time, and Gandhi came to London. My dad had worked with him, and he said, would he see these little boys? So with my brother, who was nine, and I was six, we went and sat there, went to see him. And normally, as you know, when you're a kid, you go to see a grown-up, he pats you on the head and talks to your dad. And Gandhi was sitting on the floor, and he said, come sit down beside me. So we sat next to him. Of course, I don't remember anything he said, and what I said wouldn't matter. But the power of that man, And when you think the British jailed him time and again, and he had no bitterness, and when I look at the period through which I've lived, it's quite interesting, this. The great moral leaders of my lifetime have been Gandhi, Mandela, and Desmond Tutu. Not one of them European. The people who believed in peace and reconciliation and truth. And so we've a lot to learn from the world which we once conquered.
I've got to say, I've just had an email in as we speak. Lee Winstanley says he's a great admirer of yours and he's thrilled to hear you on tonight.
Oh, good. Well, your programme's obviously got a huge influence in the Northwest.
Hopefully. Now, I know you come from a family of politicians. Your father was an MP, you were an MP.
It's worse than that. Both my grandfathers and my dad.
Oh, as well as that. Oh, right, because we've got your son Hillary.
Candidate.
Yeah. So we've got your son Hillary, who's current in the cabinet now. You've got your granddaughter was nominated as a Labour Party candidate at the last general election, but your family apart, don't you think that party politics have become a big turn-off for ordinary people these days?
Well, they say that, but I tell you what my answer is this. I think if you talk to young people, they're not apathetic about peace or war, but they don't think anyone listens to them, and they're right. And they don't believe a word they're told, and they're right about that. So I think anger and mistrust are not the same as apathy. I mean, if you take the Stop the War movement, when we had this huge demonstration in London 5 years ago, I mean, there were 2 million people there. And nobody can tell me all the young people who turned out there were apathetic. But I think trust is at the heart of good politics. And if you don't trust the people, and I think Blair, to be candid, he told us a lie to get us into the war, and people didn't trust him. I'm not being personal about him, but his policy just couldn't be trusted. So my dad said to me when I was young, he said, say what you mean what you say, do it if you have a chance, and don't attack individuals. And that's a good principle, and I've tried to stick by it.
Tony, do demonstrations work these days? They did years ago, but do they work these days?
Well, I mean, look at the cases. I mean, how did women get the vote? When my mum was born, they didn't have the vote. And the idea of women having the vote in 1897 was ridiculous. And the suffragettes, first of all, they were ignored. Then they were dangerous, the suffragettes. Then they were put in prison. And then in the end, you couldn't find anyone at the top who didn't claim to have thought of it in the first place. That's how apartheid ended. That's how all progress is made. Progress is made by people with commitment and movements that do something about it. So don't ever get depressed, because I think one of the purposes of the establishment is to demoralise us. Say, oh, you know, it'll never work, don't bother, go, it's a waste of time. And they don't want activity that might challenge their ideas and their power.
Now, Stop the War are hoping to get people on another demonstration outside the Labour Party conference in Manchester next month.
Yep.
Don't you think that maybe the people would be better, maybe, demonstrating against the rising price of fuels and the fuel costs?
Well, it's not unconnected, is it? I mean, one of the reasons why so much food and fuel are so expensive is because of the war, and the war costs money. Billions of pounds the Americans have spent, and we're spending billions. I mean, the other day, the government announced they're going to spend £3 billion on new nuclear warheads. Now, what the hell is the use of them? So they are all connected. And I think that it was a great mistake to privatise gas and electricity, because if it was still nationalised, as we did after the war, if there's a profit, it goes back to the Treasury. So the more I look at it, the more I think the old arguments seem to be more relevant. And this idea that all these socialist ideas are out of date, I find talking to people, they don't want the war, they don't want the health service privatised, they don't want schools privatised, they actually want a public service meeting their needs that we pay for through our tax.
Now, I'm talking to Tony Benn, who's going to be talking at 6:30 tomorrow at the Sylvestrian Club, Sylvester Street in Vauxhall. I know that you're a Labour man through and through, and, well, through and through, absolutely. There's no argument about that. But even you must think that Labour is now unelectable in the next election.
Well, you're talking really about new Labour, aren't you? I mean, when Blair became leader in 1994, he said, new Labour is a new political party. I'm glad he said that, because I've never been a member of new Labour. And new Labour was based on Mrs. Thatcher's economic policy. And if you doubt me, just remember when Mrs. Thatcher was asked her greatest achievement, she said New Labour. And so in a way, the death of New Labour, and I think New Labour is dying, is also the death of all the Thatcherist ideas. You know, leave the government out, borrow and spend, borrow and spend. It's all come to an end. And in a way, when Alistair Darling said this was the worst crisis for the last 60 years, at least he was telling us the truth. I mean, if I were looking at it from an ideological point of view, I'd say we're seeing the failure of British capitalism. And that's why people are prepared to look forward to new ways of doing it. And if they did that, I mean, we've got a hell of a job on our hand, but of course it can be done if we put our mind to it.
Interesting you say that, because Peter's just emailed in and says, Tony said that the majority of people see that the way Britain and America behave in terms of the war and foreign policy is entirely ridiculous and blatantly two-faced. In Britain, I don't see that I have the choice, like the Americans, to vote for a progressive, to see somebody like Barack Obama's. What politician would Tony say that we should pay attention to in this country?
Well, I work on the principle, as I say, of saying what I mean and meaning what I say. And I think if you base yourself around the issues and not personalities, people listen. For example, in the Stop the War Coalition, to go back to that for a moment, you had people of all political parties, including Conservatives against the war. That brought us together. If I do a lot of meetings for pensioners, 11 million pensioners. If you talk about pensions, people don't get divided by their ideology. They simply say we're giving the pensioners in Britain have got a rotten deal. Let's get round civil liberties. So I work on the basis. That's why I left Parliament in 2001, 7 years ago. I left Parliament because I wanted to devote more time to politics. And this is what I mean. I think this month I've got, September, I've got about 26 public meetings. I'm pounding the country. But I'm not talking about ideology. I'm saying, how can we see everybody has a job? How can we see people are not dispossessed? How can we see that kids get a decent school? How many see the health service? And politics, for most people, and for me too, is about that. Have you got a job, a home, health, education, and peace? People's requirements are very simple. They're not greedy, really, you know. We want a decent society. We don't want to see our kids killed in Afghanistan. We don't want to see war going into nuclear weapons. We want our needs met. So for me, it's about common sense, really.
I remember your fellow anti-campaigner, George Galloway, once predicting that Gordon Brown as Prime Minister would be like Tony Blair without the laugh. Has that turned out to be true or not?
Well, I don't want to be personal about it, because the trouble is politics is presented as if it was a sort of who's going to win the Oscar. Always full of personalities every day. Miliband, Brown, Darling, Rex Straw. Politics is about what people are concerned about. And there's not a lot of discussion. I mean, for example, we should have a big discussion. How soon can we get out of Afghanistan and Iraq? Now, if you did that, people would listen, because that's what interests them. But if you say who's going to be the next leader, people have a switch off.
Despite all the bad press you've had over the years, you've never lost your public appeal. You were at a gig at the Philharmonic Hall in May, which was completely sold out. Did the bad press ever hurt you?
Oh, it was horrible. I mean, I had death threats. And, do you know, funnily enough, I had a death threat a couple of years ago. I was so pleased. I haven't had a death threat for ages. I was really chuffed, because one of the final sort of corruptions of life, if you know what I mean, is from being a danger, you become a national treasure, a harmless old gentleman. So when somebody threatened to kill me last year, I did really feel I was dangerous. And so in that sense, I was very, very pleased. I've had masses of death threats.
Well, I've actually been told that's your one fear, that you don't want to be a national treasure.
Well, I don't believe in national treasures. They say I'm a kindly, harmless old gentleman. I am kindly. I am old. I could be a gentleman, but I'm bloody well not harmless.
What do you want people to take away from this meeting tomorrow that you're speaking at 6:30?
Really. You see, I think as I get older, and I'm sure you'll agree with me, the people you remember are the people who encourage you. I can remember teachers at school who said, Tony, you haven't quite got it right, but you carry on. Or when I got into Parliament, I was 25, and the old MP said, Tony, let's work together, because I think we can sort this out better. And so I think encouragement is the thing everybody needs, and that's why I hate the 11-plus exam and all that rubbish. I met a man the other day who said, I said, what do you do? He's 50. He said, well, Tony, I failed the 11-plus, as if the government announced when he was 11 he was a failure. Everybody needs encouragement. And you give encouragement in your programs, and I think that's why people listen, because when they listen to you, you help them to see a way through the problem. You're not just saying, oh, it's all disaster. no good, let's watch Big Brother and quit, you know. I think that's what people need, and that's what I try to do. It's a simple job, encourage people.
Two more questions, and then I'll let you go. One, is there any way that you know, through your years of experience, that we can get people voting again?
Well, if they believe that the commitment that their political leaders are making is true, then they'll follow it. But all this business of sound bites and focus groups and pollsters. See, I divide politicians of any party into two categories, the signposts and the weathercocks. The signpost puts his arm out and says, this is where you should go. You don't have to take the advice. If you come back in 10 years, the signpost's there. The weathercock hasn't got an opinion till he's looked at the polls, talked to the spin doctors, had a word with the focus group, and I have no time for weathercocks. So I think if you look at it like that, it makes sense to people.
However bleak, and this is the last question, please answer this however truthfully it has to be. What do you think the future is for this country?
Well, I think it depends what we do. You see, if you're frightened, and they keep us frightened deliberately. It used to be the Germans, then it was Stalin, now it's the Muslims. If you keep people frightened, they're easier to control. And fear is a prison into which we put ourselves. Hope is a fuel for progress. So instead of saying, oh, it's getting worse and worse, what could we do? If you say, let's get together and do something, then that another world is possible. That's my slogan, another world is possible. But what happens depends on what people do. And that's why perhaps my last remaining function in life as a sort of classroom assistant to the nation, I should say an untrained classroom assistant, my job is to encourage people. And you can't do more than that. I've had a lot of encouragement in my life, and the least I can do is to pass it on to people. So I hope tomorrow night in Liverpool we have a good turnout, because I said at the beginning, I love Liverpool and people from Liverpool. It's a tremendously inspiring city. And